You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And it is warm, not hot, not cold. It is in the 80s. Don, I'm going to have a great week.
It is going to be, okay, now we have to say the date. We are recording this on May 21st, 2025 for broadcast on May 22nd, 2025. The temperature today is going to be 90 degrees and tonight's low is going to be 54 degrees. And then I'm just going to read the high temperatures for the next 7 days. 84, 78, 86, 86, 86, 84, 83. Night temperatures, we're going to have one night at 49 degrees, which is a little unusual, and then 51, 53, 54. So basically mid-80s and low to mid-50s for the next week and right through the Memorial Day weekend, which is a holiday for most people. Nurseries are going to be experiencing a stampede of customers who think that they're too late to plant their tomato plants and are rushing down to grab whatever they can. Folks, there's plenty of tomato plants available at garden centers and hardware stores all around the area. You can plant all that kind of stuff. Balmy, pleasant weather for the next week.
And you can keep planting your tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, right.
Planting more tomatoes and more tomatoes.
You'll plant them all through June. Why not? And it's interesting because a week ago, I was looking at the long-range forecast for what we're now going to experience over the next couple of days, and they were talking about 94 or 95 degrees. The models have been running high. If you go to Ventusky, one of our favorite graphic sites where you can see what the wind direction is, and you can go out days and days on five different models and see what they're coming up with. They've been running high temperature, and then it's the coastal influence has been stronger than expected, I guess, is the simple answer to this. We're getting more Delta influence. One of the nice things about living on this side of the Sacramento Valley, as we do, is that when the breeze comes in from the south, southwest, it's coming off the ocean and cooling things off very nicely. So I am looking now at the long-range forecast. I will say, regrettably, the National Weather Service extended forecast has become highly truncated over the last couple of weeks. The Sacramento office is not staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as it used to be. So we're not getting the full detailed extended forecast from them. So I go to commercial sites like Weather Underground, which
is... they're getting their information from the place anyway.
Same models, although which one they choose to use, I have finally figured out that each of these commercial sites like weather.com, Weather Underground, uses one of these larger global models rather than the blend of models that the National Weather Service uses. So if you have an outlier that's higher than usual, that's probably why, that they haven't factored that in by blending the models. That was a complicated sentence there. But what it comes down to, they've been running a little bit high. Let's put it that way. They are saying at Weather Underground that a week from Friday on May 30th, it's going to be 102 degrees, which would be the first day we've broken 100 degrees this season. That's also perfectly normal in the month of May. Important to note, we very commonly get to 100 degrees in the month of May. Listeners in North Davis and West Davis who are battling the little no-see-ums, the little midges that bite them, will be happy to hear that it's going to get to 100 degrees because, as they've heard probably several times now as they've complained about this, all you need is a couple of days over 100 and that problem will solve itself. The question is whether we'll actually get that high. And typically they've been running 7 to 10 days out, have been running high and then backing off. So we're going to be warm at the end of next week, but boy, for the next 7 to 8 days, mid-80s, 50s at night, perfect planting weather, great for everything on that summer vegetable list that you have. You can plant your tomatoes and your peppers and your eggplant and your melons and your squash and your cucumbers and your corn and your pumpkins and your basil, and I think I covered most things. Okra, don't forget your okra. And if you're going to plant, Roselle hibiscus for summer tea, that's one thing you could be putting in now. All these warm season things that want warm soil, things that want warm nights can go in now. We're where we need to be for all of those kinds of things. And I would suggest you consider how much room you have before you jump into some of them, like pumpkins and watermelons. Be sure to ask how much space they take. But this is the time to start planting them. It's not late. You can plant those all the way into June. And I want people to understand, just because your neighbor planted his tomatoes in March doesn't mean that he was right. Okay? You can plant them now. It's just fine.
So that means we can plant anything. Well, not
Warm season.
really.
Warm
It's
season. Yeah.
done with the stuff that bloomed for spring.
Yeah, once we hit 90 degrees, peas, lettuce, leafy greens, people have been asking about lettuce and things like that. There are places that continue to sell them into the warm season. 90 degrees plus is just going to toast those. They are not happy about those high temperatures. So everything in the brassica group, all the cauliflower and all that kind of stuff is going to be finishing up if it hasn't already. The exceptions within that general category are Swiss chard, which in this area you can plant all year round if you wish. And I do know people who grow collards through the summer. Collards are a thicker leafed brassica. They just seem to be tougher, which to me is not that desirable from a culinary standpoint. But from a gardening standpoint, yes, collards seem to be able to take higher temperatures than other members of that group. But you just shift over now. So you're done with peas, you start planting beans, and you can do all those other things we talked about. Plus, all those flowers that we've been waiting for the heat, zinnias, asters, cosmos, which don't like to go into cold soil, sunflowers, which people have been planting since February, March, you can continue to plant all the way through June and into July. And there's lots of other flowering plants that can go in. If you're gardening in the shade, fibrous begonias, impatiens, even fuchsias, things like that are all fine to plant now. The key is to keep them watered, which obviously we'll talk about a little bit more. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from folks like you to fund our operating costs. And thanks to all of you who donated during our big spring fundraiser. If you didn't happen to get to it, you can do it any time of year by going to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And we get sent public service announcements and things like that. So, Lois, you got one, I believe.
Actually, I do. This is for Saturday, June 7th, and it says, and I quote, "Please join KDRT as we broadcast live from the Davis Pride Celebration. It will be happening at the Civic Center Park behind Davis City Hall. That's the corner of 6th and B Streets on a Saturday, June 7th. And performances include Noise Violation, the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus, Carte Blanche, Emma's Revolution, and Ada Vox, plus other drag revue, line dancing, etc. And if you can't attend in person, you can listen online at kdrt.org, no, yeah, kdrt.org or KDRT 95.7 FM in Davis. And details are at the website davispride.org.
I want to talk about one of the new-ish shows here at KDRT. It's called Taste, Talk, and Wine. All
Are
about
you doing
wine.
wine?
All about wines. Taste, Talk, and Wine. All about wines. So we have public affairs shows, and we have music shows. This is one of what we call a public affairs show. You can tune in for weekly discussions on topics related to winemaking and wine enjoyment, plus occasional guests and engagement with listeners. Topics will span the spectrum from technical growing, making, and tasting to what we're drinking to the best places to find a bottle locally. Taste, Talk, and Wine with our old
Why do
friend
you keep
Tree.
saying wine that way? Wine? Why not just say
Because
wine?
I'm pronouncing it correctly, Lois. Taste, Talk, and
Wine is wine.
Taste, Talk, and Wine is the name of the show.
And how are you spelling wine?
Whine.
Hey, you snuck an H in there. You got cute.
This is our
Oh.
old friend Tree, who also does one of the music shows here at KDRT. And he's originally from the Green Mountain state of Vermont, not the state you think of for wine production. So you come out to California and you go to Davis, where probably the world's foremost college program in viticulture and enology is housed at UC Davis. And this is a show all about the aspects of wine and people who are involved in that. And also, he has a great music program that's on Tuesdays right before my show, Jazz After Dark. So you can listen to, let's see, that one is called. I'm
Why
trying
are you looking at me? It's not before my show.
to. Someday we'll actually rehearse this program. Roots, Shoots,
Oh
and Leaves.
no, people would be so disappointed if we
Roots,
didn't.
Shoots, and Leaves is on Tuesdays, 6 to 8 p.m., right before Jazz After Dark. And then, what's the name of this program? Come on.
Wine.
Taste, Talk, and Wine, all about wine. Okay.
And as you can tell, Tree has a great sense of humor.
Yes,
Do
indeed.
you know where that original title of his other show came from?
Roots, Shoots,
Roots
and Leaves?
and Leaves.
You
You know
know,
about that?
that's an old joke.
It's a very old joke. It's okay, folks, you can go look it up.
There you
Okay, Don, let's get on with the show. We have so much to talk about.
go.
And you were talking about cosmos and sunflowers and all that sort of stuff. You're talking about planting those things. I have flowers in my yard. I had all those spring flowers that came out and were glorious. Oh, you should have seen the Strelitzia. Ah, and the Alstroemeria, huge field of Alstroemeria. But yesterday, out came deities. It's the first of the season. They're gorgeous.
That's an interesting plant because it had fallen out of favor. We're talking about fortnight lily, Moraia, Dietes. There's two different species out there. It's a South African perennial within in the iris family. And in the 1960s and 70s, it became as ubiquitous in this state as India hawthorn and Buffalo juniper. I mean, it's just one of those things that every gas station had fortnight lily planted in it. This poor plant got abused. It was put into apartment complexes where the maintenance crews would shear it for reasons that have always escaped me. It is actually a very tough, very attractive, easy to grow perennial in the iris family, which blooms constantly. Actually, it starts in April, May, and you'll have blooms on it all through the summer, unless you make one crucial mistake, which is if you go out and remove the bloom spike when you think it's done, it isn't. That same spike will bloom about every 2 weeks, hence the common name fortnight lily, even though it's an iris. Once again, common names are misleading, but the fortnight part is right. It blooms and then it stops, and it blooms again and it stops on the same bloom spike. So if you have a very fastidious gardener in your household who sees the bloom spike done and goes, "Oh, I need to remove that whole thing," they've just taken off the flowers. Also, well, they are drought tolerant. You shouldn't abuse these plants. I see them in situations where they're getting zero irrigation. Hey, guess what? They stop blooming in that situation. A really healthy, well-grown Dietes vegeta, the white and blue flowered one, the white with a blue center, is a beautiful plant. It'll have 30, 40, 50 blooms at once on it. And it looks nice and lush and green with long, spiky leaves that are iris-like, unless someone has sheared them or taken off the bloom spikes. So leave this poor
Or
plant
stop
alone.
watering.
Leave this poor plant
Yeah.
alone. Water it like a normal plant. It'll be a lovely landscape plant. And there, by the way, there's a variegated version out there that has a striped leaf that's even more showy because of that leaf, the stripe on the leaf highlights it. So here's a plant that was so overused that people got sick of it and stopped buying them. And it's a shame because it actually can be a very attractive part of the landscape. Dietes vegeta or Dietes bicolor, two different species. One's white, one's yellow. Old name is Moraia, and that's the name now being used as a common name fairly commonly. And fortnight lily is the misleading but very common name that you'll see in the trade.
And is Mariah spelled with a hidden H?
No, it's Moraea. It's also a great time to plant things for bloom midsummer and fall. And that's all those things we talked about, the zinnias, the cosmos, the asters, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a great time to do it, but you got to water them. Most of my conversations at my nursery over the last few days about plant problems have had to do with watering. Example being, well, this is all put in, the landscaper put in, set the timer to run 20 minutes twice a week. Oh, are they sprinklers? No, it's a drip system. Okay, we have to start from scratch here about how to water. So I just want to emphasize this is when the Davis Garden Show aphorism really comes into play. Check daily, water as needed. I've been planting a lot of trees from 1 gallon and 5 gallon on my property over the last 4 weeks. I've planted a couple dozen and I've got a couple dozen more to plant. And also, of course, vegetables every evening from quart pots and gallon cans, and some even from little 3-inch pots, and flowering things from little seedlings that are in 3 and 4 inch pots. I'm planting all of those things every day. So every day I check them and water as needed. And an important part of that watering as needed, and this is really the whole point of this, we go over this enough that longtime listeners already know the basics. In addition to hand watering them, because I think hand watering is more effective, more thorough, and gets you out there looking at them. I don't count on the drip system for that. I water the plant, I wash off the leaves, and I water around the plant. It doesn't take long. A lot of water is coming out of the hose when I do that. I have a soft rain nozzle. It's an actual brand, but you can get a similar nozzle that makes a rainfall, a shower of water. Not standing there with a big fire hose of water coming out, not using my thumb. In a pinch, I'll use my thumb, but usually I have a soft rain nozzle on each hose. I can stand there just a few seconds, will water that little plant's root zone. And then I wash the leaves off, which is actually really important here at our dry, hot, windy climate. Then I kind of make circles around the plant for another several seconds to water out past the plant, because another really important aphorism of the Davis Garden Show is roots won't grow into dry soil. We're starting this year with the soil very dry over almost all of California. We didn't have rainfall after about early March here. Middle of March, I think, was our last measurable rainfall here in the Sacramento Valley. Parts of Southern California, you did get rainfall, but the point is that it's been many weeks now since we've had significant measurable rainfall. So the natural soil moisture is starting the season low. Meteorologist Daniel Swain was going through this on his really important and interesting Weather West blog. He thinks it's going to be a bad fire season because you're starting with the soil dry over the entire state of California. But we had enough rain early that we got a lot of vegetation. Dry soil, lots of vegetation, bad combination. More to the point, from a gardening standpoint, that tree I'm planting, I'm digging a 5 gallon hole, as adequate moisture, although it's dry down at the bottom of that hole. I plant, I'm watering. There's no extra soil moisture down there to count on at this point. So I water. I set the hose. I really let it go a lot longer for a new tree. And then I water all around the tree. Conversation with a customer who really needs to do it all with his drip system. He's not going to go out there every day. And a lot of people can't. I understand you're not all spending all of your daylight hours outside, as some of us do. So he wanted the drip system to take care of everything it needs. I said, okay, well, you can do that. But of course, you still have to check to make sure it's actually happening. I use the drip system as my backup. This is the baseline watering, but I'm hand watering to make sure the nursery soil still gets watered and the soil just around the plant gets watered so the roots will grow outward. There's a lot of top growth and root growth going on right now at this time of year. If you want to do it with your drip system, just put a ring. If it's emitterized tubing, go ahead, cut in, get a T, go to the place that sells the parts, put a ring around the tree with that emitterized tubing, in addition to what's next to the tree. So you're watering the nursery soil, out past the nursery soil, and even out past that, so the roots can expand out. And he said, don't you want the roots to go down? I said, we all want the roots to go down, but that isn't what they do. They will to some degree, but they also go out. 85% of roots in root excavation studies have been found within the top 12 to 18 inches of soil. And usually it's the top 12 inches. Now, depending on where you are, depending on your soil and your geology, that's obviously variable, but they go out more than they go down. A root profile is not a mirror image of the top ever. And so you need to plan for that. And the simple way to plan for it with a young tree, so its roots will expand both out and down, is to water longer and expand the watering zone. I prefer to do that by hand, but if you don't have the time to go check your plants every morning before you get in your car and go to work, or if that's not your favorite thing to do at the end of the day when you get home, I mean, I walk in, drop the briefcase, close the door, go out and check on these things. That's what I do. But that's me. If you don't have the time or inclination to do that, make this extra ring so that the roots can grow into soil, even though they're not presently in that zone of soil. I hope that made sense. Hand watering, washing the leaves off, expanding the water zone, and using your drip system as a backup. If you're only going to rely on your drip system and your timer, you need to plan for the widening, the outward growth of the roots.
I have a question about soil and water and what happens when I water. So if I have this new little tree, it's wonderful, but I'm not real stable at this point, and so I'm not walking around a lot, but I have managed to throw the hose over the chips onto the tree and get it going. All right. And I set myself a little timer. Turn it off after an hour. Okay, great. I
Oh,
missed it.
hold on. Actually, let's stop right there. Those little timers are a huge part of what I do. I don't know what kind you're using, but this is just a dial.
No. On my phone, I have a timer.
Okay, what I
On
have,
my phone, I have a
I'll get we'll
timer.
get back to you in a moment here, but
The hose, go turn off the water.
what I have on each hose is a thing you can turn on, set it for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and it turns
Ah,
itself
one of
off.
those.
I have 15 of those now around my property, and anything that's newly
You
planted
have a
is on a
farm.
They're at Ace, they were 20 bucks. Okay, so these are not that big deal. And they go on the hose, you screw them right on, and they're just a timer. They're not, they're not electronic or anything. Nothing get, if the power goes out, hey, they still work. So I have one of them really important right now. Some young bare root trees that went in near my vegetable garden. Vegetables are going in. I can walk out there and I'm in a real hurry. I can just go 30 minutes. It's probably fine. It'll get water to each of those plants. And I don't have to worry about going back out and turning it off. So sorry to interrupt. Back to your programming.
You have one timer for multiple hoses, or your
Sure.
hose has sprinklers on it?
Sure.
How are you splitting it after you get the timer going?
Oh, it's very complicated, but the hose goes out and there's a Y coupling and that goes off to those things. And if they're both open, everything gets watered. And if they're only one of them's open, only those things get watered.
Okay,
But the
that's
main thing
cool.
is I don't have to
That's
go back
cool.
out. I don't have to walk back out and turn it off. So that was the whole point.
And the other thing is, you can have a Y coupler on your faucet and run out a hose and then have that timer on one of the hoses.
I have that as well, yes. So that I can hand
Yeah,
water
you don't
or I
have to have
can,
the time.
but the
The
main.
timer doesn't have to be affixed to the faucet. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right. And I implemented these things a couple of years ago and I found them incredibly useful because it is sometimes it's a hurry. And I've got seven different things and I'm hand watering the ones that I'm nearest, but I'm just, okay, let's just go turn that one on. I know in 30 minutes it'll turn off. Yeah, it's close enough. We're doing a lot of rounding when we're doing irrigation stuff. 30 minutes is fine. By the way, water coming out of a hose full throttle. That's really fast. In our case, it's a few hundred gallons per hour. So you can put a surprising amount of water on a plant at full throttle, except that it won't soak in, it'll run off. So you need to break that up somehow. Anyway, that was quite a digression. Back to you. Sorry.
No, that's a good digression. I want to ask you one more about that timer thing. Which, for those of you who aren't imagining this well, remember an old egg timer that your grandma used to have that you twisted and it'd go chuck, 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 and eventually went ding? That's what he's talking about.
Exactly. And you have a setting where you can just have it be on and not act as a timer. So you can turn it one way and it's functioning as a hose. And the other way is 30 minutes, 45 minutes. 30 minutes of a hose sitting at the base of a tree, even at a moderate flow, is a lot of water. And that's
So
an important thing to do.
does this timer reduce the water flow at all?
Probably
Mine seems to
slightly.
come out less than it goes, that's going into
Yeah,
it.
anytime the hose, any the water comes out of my well and comes out of the faucets, and that's at a certain number of gallons per hour. And yes, anytime you run it through something, you reduce that. So it probably reduces it somewhat, but not significantly enough to be real concerned. In fact, for those of you running drip systems, there's probably already a pressure regulator or a flow control on there so that it's reduced for that. Yes, it does somewhat, but not to the point that anybody needs to be concerned about it.
And you can always just turn the faucet less than full
Yep, it's
if you
just a
don't want
timer,
it full.
right? It's not a gallon meter. I remember gallon meters. Years ago, we had those. At least in theory, they were measuring the gallons that came out. Didn't think they were terribly accurate. No, this is just a timer. It's an egg timer. That's exactly what it is.
So I have a phone and I have the ability to set alarms or set timers or whatever on my phone, and then it tells me when I'm done. So I did that. And after an hour, the thing said what it was saying, and I didn't hear it. So that hose
Your tree
got
got a good
left
soaking.
on for like 4 or 5 hours before I figured out what was going on. So here's my question. See, all of that was just lead up to the question, Don. So the question is, What happened to all that water?
Well, with
Did it run? I know we have really good soils. I know it holds water. Is that recharging that one little spot, or did it read out, flow down immediately to the underground water,
So those
or
of you
what happened?
listening in the heavy soils or the hard pan zones of, say, Southern California, or the areas where you have 6 inches of sand and that's what you're calling soil, you need to understand that Lois lives on yellow fine sandy loam, which is the greatest soil in the entire world. And yes, and it has an excellent infiltration rate. So you can, if you set a hose there, it soaks in. Whereas people in, let's say, North Davis or Stonegate, where it's a more of a clay loam, not a sandy loam, pretty quickly, within 5 to 10 minutes, that water would have been flowing out, running off, going down the path or whatever, going somewhere else. Now, we're very, very flat here in Davis. I think there's a grand total drop from one side of town to the other of about a couple feet, if that, 5 feet. Yeah, total. And so the average yard is so level that you don't have to worry that much about where the water is going to go if there's a surplus of it. What it does in your case and in mine, I'm on a silty loam, is it soaks in, but in the denser the soil, the more it goes out and the less it goes down. So if you're in one of the clay loam parts of town, pretty quickly that water is going to be puddling up and then spreading outward. And a shrub 6 feet away may benefit from it. It may go that far if you leave it on at a high volume for that long. In your soil, most of it went down into the ground. So you gave that tree a very deep watering. Congratulations. That's actually very good. One thing I found,
It has short roots. It's a very young tree.
it's not making use of it yet. One thing I found on my property long ago is that when there's a leak or something and water's puddling in one area, well, one, wildlife likes it. I find all kinds of interesting footprints there the next day. But also, whatever tree is nearest to that usually puts on a nice surge of growth, which tells me that it benefits from it. It goes out and down, and how far out or down it goes depends on your soil type. The coarser your soil, that is to say, the closer it is to sand, which is one of the larger soil particles, the more it goes down, the more the water goes down. The watering shape would be like a elongated U. In the case of clay soils, it goes out considerably, 2 to 1, 3 to 1, outward versus down, which is why they're challenging. It doesn't, the infiltration rate is poor. And if you're, and silty loam is in between. So mine, I can water it pretty full throttle for a while, and then it begins to puddle and go outward. The answer is it went to something roots, some kind of roots nearby, because I know you have trees near in your backyard, and other things certainly made use of it. What we don't want, so it wasn't a waste of water. You didn't do any harm. Other plants nearby would certainly benefit from it. What obviously we don't want is in heavier soil areas where you have any kind of a slope for the water to be flowing off the property. That's a waste of water. City doesn't like it, and it's of no benefit. So if you inadvertently leave it on, overwatering doesn't mean what you just did. Overwatering isn't too much water all at once. Overwatering is watering too frequently. Overwatering is our shorthand way of saying you made the plant more prone to crown rot by keeping it too damp around the crown. We aren't saying you put on 20 gallons of water. Oh my goodness, that's going to kill the tree. No, it just soaked in, went out. You can probably go a bit longer before you need to water again, but you can't really count on that because remember, you don't have that much of a root system that you just
Yeah.
put in there. So.
And the what how does all of what we're talking about now, where you water and the water infiltrates in different directions and amounts, and how does that relate to what's called the water table?
The water table for groundwater is way down there.
Really?
Groundwater, we're on, for those of you outside the area, we are on, many people here are on wells. I'm on a deep well on my, relatively deep well on my property. Farmers tend to have somewhat shallower wells. In town, they use surface water most of the time. 70 to 90% of our water in Davis comes from the Sacramento River now. That's relatively new, about 15 years ago. Prior to that, it came from wells that were 700 to 1,000 feet deep. And before that, from wells that were only 400 to 500 feet deep. You're watering your plum too long in your context. Doesn't go down to the water table. It stays in the general root zone. We don't have a shallow high water table here. There are places where they do, but we don't. We have when a long ditch was run through my property, middle of the drought back in 2015, irrigation district had to dig a 15 to 20 foot deep trench through my property to put a brand new 42 inch line through my property to go to the farmers on the other side of the freeway. And it was a little irritating and it was a big job. It took them all summer. But what was interesting about it was that they left that ditch open one night, which is rather dangerous. But I went down in there to look at my soil. And my soil was silty loam all the way down. I had no B layer. I had no compacted zone as you typically do in an agricultural area. So water applied at the surface, your plum water would have just gone straight down 10, 12, 15 feet if you put enough water on. That's not the typical case. Typically, you have a place where agricultural equipment has compacted a zone 18 to 24 inches down. And so water hits that and goes out at that zone, and you get a saturated zone whenever you have a difference in soil texture. So you always have, if there's a dramatic difference in soil texture when one type of soil perched on another or compacted by machinery, water will hit that and spread out before it soaks through, if it even will soak through. That depends on whether it's rock or what kind of soil it is. You're not watering down to the water table when you do what you just did, but you are increasing the moisture available to deeper rooted plants in the vicinity. And people need to start looking around them, realizing you're walking across a rhizosphere of roots from trees and shrubs and perennials wherever you are, pretty much, unless it's completely barren of vegetation. Roots will explore when they can. They grow into moist soil when they can in the spring until the rainfall moisture runs out, or in the summer if irrigation continues. And your neighbor's lawn watering is watering your tree. Your lawn watering is watering your neighbor's tree. They go out more than down. And so you are contributing to the moisture in that rhizosphere. Thank you.
I love that word, the rhizosphere. I hadn't heard that word before. That's going to be one of my new favorite words, I
It
think.
comprises the whole zone where the roots are growing, all of the mycorrhizae and other beneficial organisms that live on or in those roots and around them, and all that other stuff. It's a whole, there's more carbon sequestered down there typically than above ground. So it's a really important part of every aspect of why we garden, why we plant trees, how we manage irrigation. The big relevance of this, if you abruptly change that, let's say you decide you're not going to have a lawn anymore, and you've been watering your lawn, every day for 20 minutes, and you decide, okay, I'm going to do the right thing, I'm going to go to a low water landscape. That's fine. But you were watering a significant, probably 2,000 to 4,000 square foot rhizosphere that was certainly occupied, is certainly occupied by trees and shrubs nearby. And if you suddenly change that, please keep watering them. Not nearly as much as you were before. You certainly don't need to keep watering them as if it's a lawn, but some species, birches, maples, willows, coast redwood, if you dramatically reduce the irrigation in that zone, they will be very adversely affected. Other species can adjust pretty readily, but you'll see some differences in how much growth you get that season. So if you take out your lawn, put in irrigation, or just do this manually, to periodically, every 2 weeks in the case of higher water trees, every 4 weeks or so in the case of lower water trees, give them a really thorough watering, like Lois just did with her plum. And drip works great. Drip can work great for that if you run it long enough. I run drip lines on some parts of my property 12 to 24 hours because I'm doing it every couple to 4 weeks, depending on what the trees are. And so it's an overnight thing. Whereas most of my others are 2 to 4 hours, depending on what kind of tree they are and what age they have. So
And
it's,
what sprinklers you're using?
yeah, and conventional orchards, they'll use those impulse sprinklers very commonly, what we call Rainbirds. That's a brand. That kind of, yeah, those, there you go. I was going to do a very good imitation of a Rainbird. They do those in part because within, say, 6 or 8 hours, they can get the amount of irrigation they want to get a 1 to 2 foot depth of penetration. Many have gone over to more efficient irrigation, but they have to run them a lot longer. And so they know that. Farmers know that. They go by soil moisture. They use moisture sensors or things like that. But for home gardeners, if you shift over to a micro spray or drip system, be aware, we can help you calculate this. You need to run it a lot longer, but obviously not as often as you were doing, say, your lawn. So that was quite a digression, as usual, at the Davis Garden Show.
Well, no, we, but you know, I wanted us to talk about soil and water and all that other stuff, and I'm going to keep it going one little bit longer, and that has to do with the roots. Now, you've heard Don say many a time, roots won't grow into dry soil. We're talking about the new roots won't grow into dry soil. If you have a tree and it has roots, it has things underground that, well, sort of look like your arm. They're big, they're sturdy, they're and
Roots.
then and then coming out of them, they have smaller things, sort of like your fingers. And coming out of them, you have little hair roots now.
I want the
What I
illustration for this conversation.
Oh, I could do that. I'll set I AI to do
There
it
you
now.
go.
But what happens with a deciduous tree is that the hair roots go away.
They die right away. Yes, they when they can't when they
And
can't when there's no moisture, the white root hairs die and the root stops. But they're protected by wood, just as the branches are. So roots are woody. They're highly variable, interestingly. And we tend to make a lot of assumptions about root systems. But people who have dug a lot of trees, or dug around them, or have planted a lot of different kinds of trees, or handled a lot of bare root trees, can tell you there's significant differences in how woody the roots are. So how likely they are to protect the root in the case of protracted drought. You think about the species from high rainfall areas, they tend, I'm just generalizing here, but they tend to have less protection on their roots, like maples, for example. And so if drought progresses, they'll keep dying back. They'll keep withering back gradually as the season goes along. And eventually you'll see that reflected in the appearance of the top. Whereas a lot of other trees, like desert willow, things that from places where they evolved with intermittent long periods of drought, have much more protected roots and can quickly form new root hairs to grow in when moisture comes along. So some cactus, for example, within 24 hours of rainfall, new root hairs are forming, and they're already soaking in water, and then it's being taken into the cactus and going into specialized storage cells for water storage that can get them through months of no rainfall. Rainfall stops, the fine root hairs immediately die. There's enough of a protective coating, bark, if you will, a skin-like coating on the remaining roots that they just stop, and they even put a protective scar over the end, and they wait 6, 8, 12 months for the next rainfall. And there have been trees, for example, in the years we've been in business, we used to carry some shade trees bare root. Mostly we just get fruit trees bare root, but these are literally, as the name implies, things that are grown in a field, dug up, soil washed off, sent to the nursery, and sold bare root. And there are some that would come in, birch trees, Don Redwood, Meta Sequoia, where the tag would say, and the sales rep would emphasize, you should pot these right away. These have thin roots. They dry out too quickly for you to hold them bare root. And they were right. These are trees that would have a very high mortality rate if we didn't immediately pot them up and keep those roots moist, moister than the shavings or whatever would provide for a typical bare root tree. So trees are variable with respect to their ability to get through drought because of the anatomy, the structure of their roots, and the nature of the protective coating, and also how quickly they regrow. Many of these are plants from regions where it rains all the time when they're growing and they have a long dormant season. Those are generally not our best species here in the dry, Xeric California. Some of them adapt well, but you have to irrigate accordingly. So the roots are variable, but they will quickly explore soil that's moist, and they're making significant growth, we know, in the spring, which is now. So if you want to keep that growth going, keep that water where it needs to be, and that's in the area that roots are growing into, not just where they are. Common picture I get, and I've already had two this season, and I'm sure I'll get a dozen or more. Little citrus tree, subtropical plant, should grow during the warm season, planted correctly, being given the same number of gallons we talked about, being watered correctly, and just doing nothing. When the picture arrives, it's surrounded by bare dirt. Nothing is watering the bare dirt, and that dirt is being baked by the sun, so no roots are going to grow in there. So really important there, like I was describing at the top of the show, hand water past the existing root zone so the roots can get out, and even better, mulch them so that there's that when you do provide moisture out there, it's shaded by the mulch and retained by the soil. And one other big exception to everything we've talked about, of course, is raised planters, because they're basically large containers.
Well, Don, I have my usual questions, and I know these are usual questions because he sent me a list and said, ask these questions every week. Okay. So, Don,
Yes.
what's blooming in your yard right now?
You mentioned Alströmeria, and that's a really good one, actually. Alströmerias are in full bloom. I'll tell you, though, the most spectacular thing in my yard right now is my clematis. Or clematis. I learned clematis. Then I heard moved up to Northern California, heard people here saying clematis, and I adopted that. Take your pick. It doesn't matter how you pronounce it. Clematis jackmannii, my purple flowered one, which has about 300 blooms on it right now, does this every year. It's a 35-year-old plant. They can live for a very, very, very long time. And I really wish more people would just sort of sneak them into landscapes. This is the way you do these. This is a plant that grows on top of shrubs, climbs up into rose bushes, goes on a trellis. If you remember to put one up when it first comes up, it's a very fast-growing herbaceous perennial vine. Okay, that's a long.
Isn't it a bulb?
No, it's a root mass. It's a root clump, and this 35-year-old plant. The way to plant them is what I did here, evidently. Plant it back behind shrubs, so it's getting watered with them, and so the roots are shaded by those shrubs as they grow. In my case, it was Sarcococca. It was a bed where I just let everything grow for years and years and years, and every year, about the first week of March, up would pop the clematis, and within 2 weeks, it's 10 feet. I mean, it just grows insanely fast. So at some early in the season, at some point, you have to make a decision where it's going to go that year. Going to let it run all over the shrubs, going to let it climb up into a tree, going to put up a trellis for it, whatever you're going to do. Well, a couple of years ago, I had to take out all those shrubs. I had to cut them all to the ground. All the Sarcococca had to go to the ground so I could clean that bed out. And I found that this clematis, 35 years in, is now a root clump 3 feet across. And it had the whole bed to itself now. So one, I mulched it because all those leaves and shade had been taken out. And I made sure a drip line got to it. And I also hand watered that one. And I looked at this thing coming up and I thought, now what? And so I took a tomato cage. I took one of my regular 6 foot tomato cages, okay, put it over the thing before it escaped, and securely anchored that because we get strong winds through our farm. And it filled it completely and cascaded back down to the ground and turned into this unbelievable display. So if you're looking for a way to deal with clematis and you don't have anything for it to climb, I suggest a large tomato cage. Other than that, I really don't do anything for this plant, and I really haven't. I keep it watered. That's normal watering on that bed, nothing special. And I figure out what it's going to climb on. And when it's all done blooming and we get into the winter, I cut it to the ground. That's what you do with the Jack Manny type clematis. They're the easiest to grow. And I can't think of a plant that gives me this much bloom with this little input. Yeah, I mean, seriously, there are hundreds of blooms on there, and it's this vivid royal purple color. I will take a picture and put it on the show page for this week.
You said that you couldn't think of one that was easier to care for. I have one. Only though, if you have a farm with a big shed on it, and that is the evergreen clematis. You don't cut it to the ground every year, and yeah, it just keeps going and going and going and climbing and taking. It's just, but the blossoms, pure white.
Yeah, and that one here is early. That one blooms before all the others. It starts blooming February to March. It has a lemony scent to the flower, so it's really cool. It is a vigorous plant, and people need to understand. I believe up in the Pacific Northwest, people consider it mildly invasive. The whole genus, actually, there's a lot of species of clematis, and there's hundreds of hybrids out there. So they fall into three basic categories. The evergreen, there's just one, Clematis armandii, which blooms early, scrambles all over things. You don't have to cut it back. You're just going to cut it back because it's gotten away from you. That's really the
only
reason.
You keep the door so you can walk into the shed.
So you can get into the house, yes. The Jack Manny groups, basically, there's a bunch of them where they bloom on this year's growth. So you cut them to the ground. They're an herbaceous perennial. They come up, they bloom. They're very manageable, and there's no special pruning involved. You don't have to prune them back. If you don't, the blooms will just be further out on whatever you've let them grow up onto. At times in the past, I've let this one go up into a tree nearby, and it blooms very nice. There, you cut them back mainly for size control and to renew the bloom that way. And then there are the ones that bloom on new wood, and they're very cool, but you got to know that they bloom on new wood. And that's one of those bits of horticultural jargon that I wish we wouldn't use, but new growth turns into new wood the next year. All right, so what grows this year?
Last year's. Why don't you just say last year's?
Well,
growth?
Because people use this term, so that's why I'm using it. Because you're going to encounter this if you go to read about clematis, where they make it seem incredibly complicated to grow and prune them. No, there's just some that don't bloom on new growth. So if you cut them back to the ground, you'll never see them flower. These are the Clematis montana group, and so that's pretty easy to remember. They can take heat and drought better than others. Just think of Montana, and they have a lovely smell like vanilla. They have a very sweet, sweet smell, like someone's making vanilla cookies or something. And they bloom very early, February to March. They're all done before the Jack Mannies start to bloom in the month of May. And then the Jack Mannies, which are the main ones most people know, finish up here, May, June, early July. And the Tanguticas start blooming in the midsummer. So you can have clematis blooming in February, March, May, June, July, and then you can seek out the autumn clematis and you can have one blooming September, October. I suggest you start collecting them now. Easy to grow. Just put them in the ground someplace where you won't disturb them. That's really the key. They're not easy to dig up and move if you change your mind. And they like to be mulched and they like, moisture on the roots, but they're not that fussy about it. And it's considered to be best to shade the roots. And I've certainly had that experience. They'll grow into full sun and bloom in full sun, but they'll also bloom in some shade. So really, really easy plant to grow.
Okay, so are you still starting stuff from seeds or have you stopped that?
Oh, we are heavily in production now on cucumbers, melons, squash, pumpkins. Those in particular are the things we're starting in a big way, both at our nursery and that I'm doing at home as well. Because they germinate in about 5 days, first of all, they come up in no time. And it's a saleable plant about a week after that. So for people who are looking for cucumbers and things like that, nurseries don't even usually start planting them until night temperatures are warm enough to sustain the seedling. It's a great time to do all of those kinds of things. We're also doing a lot of zinnias and we're still doing sunflowers and that kind of thing. We'll continue to do those at our nursery all the way into June because we are trying to get more people to do succession plantings on some of those things. Cucumbers in particular. If you're a fan of cucumbers, quick overview here. The ones that you see in the store, regular green cucumbers, don't grow those in your garden. You're gonna get bitter ones and they're gonna disappoint you. Grow burpless types, which are also basically burpless, Japanese, English forcing, greenhouse, bait alpha. These are all names you'll see on the kind you see in the store wrapped in plastic. It's that kind. Very thin peel, very sweet, very small seed cavities, usually seedless. In fact, many of them are gynoecious and parthenocarpic. You can look those terms up if you like.
What?
Yeah, gynoecious and parthenocarpic, which means functionally what it means is they barely have any seeds. They're basically seedless. And a lot of people find the seeds of cucumbers hard to digest. So these are often called burpless for that reason in the United States. Other countries, they have a different name for them. Most cucumbers that you plant will grow vigorously for about 3 or 4 weeks. They'll continue, but for the first 3 to 4 weeks, they're mainly growing. Then they start to fruit. They fruit very rapidly, one of the fastest producing things you can plant in your summer vegetable garden. And then they fruit for about 4 to 6 weeks. And that's it for that plant. So they're done. And some of them have given you 4 or 5 cucumbers in that time period. Some of the ones like Bait Alpha give me 10 to 12 cucumbers, but it's in 4 to 6 weeks. And the plant is kind of played out. Yeah, it's still trying to fruit, but it's just kind of worn out. So if you had planted some more 2 to 3 weeks after that first batch, and some more 2 to 3 weeks after the second batch, you can actually have cucumbers all summer long. More commonly, people plant a whole bunch of them early, and that's why you find so many pickle and relish recipes in cookbooks.
So, I know that tomatoes, many tomato varieties, not all, don't set when it gets hot. Do cucumbers have a problem setting when it gets hot?
I haven't noticed any particular problem with that. They seem to be fine with the heat. Their traditional types get more bitter when it's hot. That's the correlation I've seen. You can look up, why is my cucumber bitter? And just for the record, zucchini sometimes gets that same bitterness. There's a compound in them that makes them bitter. But they'll tell you in almost every reference you look at, oh, it's a watering problem. It's, erratic water. No. That's bunk. Okay. I have watered them absolutely correctly and perfectly, and I'm reasonably sure I know what I'm doing. And they're bitter when we have a heat wave, when the plant is stressed. So, yes, if you don't water correctly, stress could be a factor, but so is high temperature. Whereas these other ones I mentioned, lemon cucumbers, Persian cucumbers, burpless cucumbers, just aren't bitter. I just have never had a bitterness problem on them. Yes, cucumbers need real even moisture. That's very important. So they should be on the same line with your bell peppers and things like that. Generally, very easy to grow, but each plant tends to finish up after a few weeks. So consider, as you do with corn, as some people do with bush beans, consider successive plantings of cucumbers. All the other things I mentioned, melons, squash, that's not necessary. They're going to grow their allotted span, produce their allotted fruit, and that's what you're growing them for. But cucumbers, which are very popular, people are often frustrated with them. Be sure not to let them get drought stressed. Water them deeply. Keep them growing vigorously. This is really the key, and you'll get good yield. And then consider replanting as late as the 1st of August for your last crop of cucumbers. Then you can eat fresh cucumbers instead of trying to figure out what to do with those overripe yellow cucumbers, and you're now looking up chow chow and relish recipes.
Well, we have a message here from Tara, who is in Oakland, California. She writes, "Good evening. Last week's show about knowing what your pest is before you apply a pesticide is the subject of my question. I have a rose that has very spotted leaves, but it doesn't look precisely like black spot to me. Can you ID it?" And she sends some pictures. Don, what do you think?
Yeah, these are great pictures. I would flip that leaf over and look on the underside for orange pustules of rust. Rust is very recognizable on the bottom side of the leaf. You don't usually see the spores themselves on the top side of the leaf. And if you take your thumb and rub it across the underside of the leaf, it's the same color as Cheetos cheese puffs. So it's pretty obvious what it is when you get rust. Rust is a fungus. It splashes. It is a big, heavy spore. So the only way rust gets higher on a leaf is when you're sprinkling with some velocity, or nature is sprinkling with some velocity enough to cause spores to splash upward. It's one of the three major rose diseases: downy mildew, powdery mildew. Well, actually, four: downy mildew, black spot, powdery mildew, and rust are the four big rose diseases, and they vary in intensity in different places. We don't get much black spot here, for example, but downy mildew can be a big problem in a wet spring. Rust is a frustrating one when you get it, but it's also actually pretty easy to get rid of by just removing every leaf that has the spores, or cutting the plant back hard again as if it were January, which is what I end up recommending most of the time. Someone will come in with a picture of a rose that's just so covered with rust that it's really ugly. Prune it back, pretend it's January, cut it back hard, take everything, throw it all away, give it a good soaking, maybe give it some fertilizer because you have stressed it a bit by removing all the growing points, and you'll probably get some new growth right away. And the new growth typically will come up unaffected. As we get into hotter, drier temperatures here in the valley, at least, rust is not a continuing problem, but it can be in milder climate areas. And it's very cosmetically, well, it's ugly to put it mildly. So it's something where you just remove it, basically. There used to be fungicides that were effective on rust. They're long off the market. Anyone who sells you a fungicide for rust, I'm very, very dubious about the efficacy of it. So removing it is going to be your simplest answer here.
Okay, and she continues. I have some 4-inch tall zinnias that I started from seed. Most of them look fine, but the ones I planted out in the far end of my garden look devoured. I was guessing maybe earwigs, so I put out 2 bowls of olive oil last night, but didn't catch a single earwig. I've occasionally been applying slug bait in the area for different plants, so I don't suspect them. Please help me protect my seedlings. And she sends a picture of that, and the picture is amazing. It's like a lace,
Yes.
and
Lace leaf
wow.
zinnia. That looks more like snail or slug damage to me, actually. I'm having experienced a lot of that over my many years as a gardener. The size of the holes, the nature of the holes, it looks more like snails or slugs. And it's not too shocking that you're not catching them with the bait. They're very attracted to seedlings. And so, again, as we often say, one of your best answers is to take a flashlight, go out at night and see if you can, and do some inspection and see what you find. If it is earwigs, there's a lot of them, because it would take many earwigs to cause this much damage on the leaves, whereas just a smaller number of snails or slugs would do it. Sluggo is a bait that's used for snails and slugs. It's become the most popular because it's relatively low toxicity. Just iron phosphate breaks down into fertilizer components. There's a Sluggo product called Sluggo Plus, where they have added an insecticide. They've added spinosad, which is an organic insecticide, but it's an insecticide that's done for earwigs. I haven't seen real good efficacy with that because earwigs aren't that attracted to bait. So my guess is what you're dealing with here is snail damage. And if it's on one end of the garden, it's probably near the plants where the snails are breeding. And in this area, that's usually Agapanthus or daylilies or ivy or overgrown vegetation that traps moisture, because they really like that. And so you might, if you're using bait, put it near them as well as near the little seedlings that you've put out. But I'm guessing snails, a flashlight brigade at midnight would probably answer the question better.
All right.
And we had a question that I think I sent over to you right before we started the show. So I'll go ahead and read this one. It was about an olive. And this is olive trees have become really popular again for some reason. This sort of cyclical thing. They're very Mediterranean looking, and I love them. I think olives are wonderful trees. They're very drought tolerant. They're very heat tolerant. Great choice for a low water landscape. And many of us are allergic to the pollen, so we're not too thrilled about this trend, but that's a minor side effect. And then the fruit, of course, can be an issue. But here was a simple, straightforward question. If you have a multi-trunk olive tree and one branch dies, have you overwatered it? So a multi-trunk olive tree. So first of all, olives usually don't have a single trunk. The way they grow, they're like a giant shrub. They're like a crepe myrtle. Their natural growth habit is multi-trunk. Certainly, growers do you a favor, stake them up, train them, whatever. But this guy had a multi-trunk. One died. One branch died. Rest of the tree looks fine.
I can't imagine that it would be overwatering, because if it got crown rot, the whole thing would be gone.
Typically, yeah, there are diseases that'll attack a branch, but more commonly, if you're overwatering, Phytophthora, crown, and root rot, the rest of the tree would look at least affected, even if only one part of it was directly affected.
Does this get fire blight?
No, but there is a borer that came into California in the 1970s when I was a student, and it started attacking Raywood ash, privets. Well, most people weren't too upset about that. Lilacs, which are all closely related, and olives. And those olives, lilacs, and privets are all in the same family. So if you happen to be allergic to olives, you might be allergic to privets. And you might even be allergic to lilacs. Who knows? And what this does, there are Raywood ash planted around Davis. It was a popular tree back in the 70s and 80s when it was introduced by Saratoga Horticultural Foundation. It's a small ash tree. So it's well-mannered. It doesn't get huge. Good branch structure. Nice-looking tree. Generally very tough. But this borer would attack a branch. So an otherwise healthy tree would have one branch die, and then another branch would die. But the rest of the tree looks fine. It's the ash lilac borer. It's in most of California now, I believe. And on olives, it does the same thing. One branch or one trunk, if you have a multi-trunk olive, you can usually find the point of infestation, but not always. It's not a real obvious point of infestation. This is a really simple one. You prune that out, you get rid of it, that usually solves the problem. No, you don't treat it with anything. There's nothing really that works that well on borers anyway. It almost never kills the tree. It just causes a branch to die. In the case of Raywood ash, it's the main reason, other than the other issues with ash trees, with surface roots and whatnot, that we stopped recommending Raywood ash years ago. Just this one, by the way, other ash trees don't seem to get it. So you look at a healthy Raywood ash. Davis residents want to see some examples. You know where Nugget Market is in North Davis, CVS Pharmacy, the parking lot there, which has got examples of everything wrong about growing shade trees. But there are some really healthy trees in that parking lot as well, including some Raywood ash. And almost every one of them that you look at, a branch here and a branch there is dying. It happened to one of my lilac bushes years ago. I'm not sure how it got to my farm way out in the country. One side of the plant died. I pruned it out. I took it away, and I've never had the problem since. And it does happen on olives occasionally as well. Ash, lilac, borer. If the tree otherwise looks healthy, that's what I would expect.
Well, we like to end the show with a garden quote, and today I have one that, well, you've probably heard this one. It's a really good one. Learn from others' mistakes. You don't have time to make them all yourself.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter. I hear at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
There is some great programming here at KDRT, and you'll find the Yolo County Breakdown with DJ Rocky Outcrop live Fridays, 10 to 11 a.m. From Bill Monroe to Billy Strings, the Yolo County Breakdown is a journey through bluegrass and newgrass music, acoustic string music, and the spirit of American roots and country that was born through the genius of Bill Monroe and his bluegrass boys, but which has spread and flowered to be an art form that is uniquely American. As Duke Ellington wrote, there are simply two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. Rocky Outcrop likes the good kind. Listen to what he's spinning on KDRT, Fridays 10 to 11.